Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital the government does not want you to know. I just came back from my vacation in my hometown of Nashville, Tennessee, spent Hanukkah there with my family, and actually spent most of Saturday night in a country bar, kind of reconnecting with, some might call it red state music. I don't. I just say it's American music. And those kinds of values, which in many ways I share, at least the values of the music. I'm not a big fan of Alabama and that the voters just chose to extend their Jim Crow laws, but I do like the song Sweet Home Alabama, and I had a good time there. Today is Tuesday. That means that it's Debate Tuesday. Hey, it used to be called Election Tuesday, but the election's over. Still, it is Debate Tuesday, and my guest today will be one of my favorite guests here on the Inside Scoop. He is the state chair of the Utah College Republicans, Tom Robbins. He'll be on in just a few minutes to answer your questions and my own on really any issue you want to talk about. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can always contribute to the blog and ask your questions there just by going to www.radioinsidescoop.com. There's mostly two political issues in the news. There's some non-political issues. I don't really care to comment on the Scott Peterson trial except to say that sometimes I do support the death penalty and it looked deserved in that case. But the main issues in the news that I've seen are, of course, Bernie Kerik, Bush's nominee to be Homeland Security Director, his sudden withdrawal from the race, and the astonishing press conference in Kuwait where the troops, well, they kind of dressed Don Rumsfeld down, our Secretary of Defense, and we're going to be playing some of those things and getting your comments, and I really want to hear Tom's comments on that. Let's start with Bernie Kerik. Bernie Kerik, of course, was the police commissioner in New York, and a lot of things came up that did not derail his nomination. One is that he had connections with the mob. He also received from private contractors lots of gifts, including a $2,000 bejeweled Tiffany badge. He had, in addition to his adulterous affairs and his financial and legal problems, he received $6.2 million from a taser company that was doing business with the Department of Homeland Security. But these conflicts of interest did not stop his nomination. No, they were considered just fine. Mayor Giuliani pushed him through. But hey, Republican nominees, of course they have interest. They are always doing business with the same people. I mean, look at Vice President Cheney. Head of Halliburton was doing business with Saddam Hussein, doing business with Iran, and now is doing business with the U.S. government. No one considered a conflict of interest there. No, what brought down Bernie Kerik was Nannygate. He, like so many nominees in the past, both Democratic and Republican, hired a woman to clean his house and did not know her immigration status, did not pay taxes, and that Bush's press guy assures us, that is the reason why his nominee was brought down. Not ties with the mob, not conflicts of interest. No, we can understand that. No, it's all about Nannygate. And so the same White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan that said we have full confidence in Bernie Kerik's integrity said it just a few hours before he withdrew his nomination. Warning, watch out when Bush has Bremer said that, hey, we need more troops now in Iraq, and he was fired for that. And Bush, of course, also expressed full confidence in John Ashcroft right before he left office, as well as in George Tenet and in the quality of our intelligence. So watch out for full confidence. One person whom John McCain has no confidence in, unlike the president's full confidence, is in Don Rumsfeld. And I thought it was pretty courageous of McCain to come out and say that he has no confidence in Don Rumsfeld. Of course, we Democrats have had no confidence in the man for several years now. But that largely came up due to a response by Don Rumsfeld, I think, are fair questions. One of the most famous came from a soldier from my home state of Tennessee, a guy by the name of Thomas Wilson, who asked a very straightforward question. He said that, Mr. Secretary, Don Rumsfeld, we've had troops in Iraq for up to 3 years and have always staged out of Kuwait. In other words, this isn't a new problem. And, well, let me play for you exactly what the soldier had to say and Rumsfeld's response.
We soldiers have to dig through local landfills for pieces of scrap metal and compromised ballistic glass to up-armor our vehicles, and why don't we have those resources readily available to us?
Quick note, check out...
I missed the first part of your question, and could you repeat it for me?
That was also interesting, I thought. Rumsfeld missed the first part of the question. Did you hear the laugh of the troops? I think they know it's a difficult question for him to answer, but let's give him a chance.
Okay. Our soldiers have been fighting in Iraq for coming up on 3 years. A lot of us are getting ready to move north relatively soon. Our vehicles are not armored. We're digging pieces of rusted scrap metal and compromised ballistic glass that's already been shot up, dropped, busted, picking the best out of this scrap to put onto our vehicles to take into combat. We do not have proper armament vehicles to carry with us north.
I talked to the general coming out here about the pace at which the vehicles are being armored. They have been brought from all over the world, wherever they're not needed, to a place here where they are needed. I'm told that they're being done, and it's essentially a matter of physics. It isn't a matter of money. It isn't a matter on the part of the Army of desire. It's a matter of production and capability of doing it. As you know, you go to war with the army you have, not the army you might want or wish to have at a later time. Since the Iraq conflict began, the Army has been pressing ahead to produce the armor necessary. They believe it's a greatly expanded rate from what existed previously, but a rate that they believe is the rate that is all that can be accomplished at this moment.
Now, I have lots of comments on this, as you might imagine. First of all, is it a fair question? I'll ask Tom that, but I think it is. Rush Limbaugh focused on the fact that the soldier had asked a reporter to help him frame the question as if that were the scandal. Kind of reminds me of what they did with Dan Rather's report. We know, of course, George Bush violated several express orders to attend in National Guard, and they focused on the part that Rather got. Really have to go to dumps and pick up stuff and try to get it there. Well, what does Rumsfeld say? He says, well, you know, you got to deal with the army you have, not the army you want. As if we didn't know way back January of 01, Bush first decided to invade Iraq, right? He had 3 years to get it together, as this soldier points out. And we don't have the army we want. And that's largely because Rumsfeld wanted to do it on the cheap. That was his goal. He wanted to take very few troops. Didn't mention. And so, his statement. Let me read to you what Rumsfeld said after this. Rumsfeld says, quote, "It's interesting. I've talked a great deal about this with a team of people who've been working on it hard at the Pentagon. And if you think about it, you can have all the armor in the world on a tank, and a tank can be blown up. You can have an up-armored Humvee, and it can be blown up. And you can go down, and the vehicle, too." Unquote. Now, think about this. Here's what he says. He says, if you think about it, don't you think that the soldier, Thomas Wilson, has thought about it? Don't you think that everyone in the room has thought about it? Think about the condescension of that statement. He's sitting around in the Pentagon talking, hey, you know, if you think about it, our troops could go into war without guns, without helmets. Because even if they have guns, and if they have helmets, even if they have tanks, they can still be killed. You know, use protections. Some comfort to our people in the military, particularly from the guy who wanted to go to war on the cheap. Another questioner asked very specifically, my question, what is the Department of Defense, more specifically the Army side of the house, doing to address shortages and antiquated equipment that National Guard soldiers such as the 116th Cavalry Brigade are going to roll into Iraq with? To which Rumsfeld responded, in any organization you're going to have equipment and material and spare parts of different ages. In other words, tough it out, soldier. We tough it out here in the Pentagon, sending you out there. You should tough it out. Complain about it. Well, you're just crybabies. That's at least how I saw Rumsfeld's statement. But I suspect Tom Robbins has a different view, and I'm going to bring him on air and ask. Tom, do you think, first of all, welcome again to the Inside Scoop.
Hey, Hey, thanks for having me, Mark.
Now, tell me, what did you think of Rumsfeld's comments in Kuwait?
Well, you know, the first thing that comes to mind, it's I'm glad and I'm proud to be an American, a place where the average grunt soldier has the opportunity to look the Secretary of Defense in the eye and ask him a pointed question, one that might be hard to answer or know that might cause discomfort to him. And then afterwards, it goes around the entire media circuit where it ends up on the Mark Levin show, and we're talking about it more than a week later. Now, if that would have happened in Iraq, if he would have been an Iraqi soldier and he would have had the opportunity to go face-to-face with Saddam Hussein and ask him, hey, I'm an Iraqi soldier forced into the military, and I don't have the opportunity to have proper shoes, I have outdated everything, and I am just being destroyed by the American Army, that person and everyone around him and associated with him would have been summarily taken out back and shot in the head and executed by Saddam Hussein and his thugs.
At least in America,
we have the opportunity to question our leaders and to have them done, and the Pentagon is looking very hard at this, and they're speeding up the production and doing everything possible to get that armor to our troops.
Well, let me get to the production and ask these kinds of questions. Of course, it's been very rare that Rumsfeld has gone in and asked these questions, and the person who is least likely to face pointed questions, of course, is the President of the United States. George Bush has had 16 press conferences, about four a year to this point in his presidency. Bill Clinton had three times that many. His father, George H.W. Bush, had more than five times that many press conferences. Just to give an idea, George Bush's father had a press conference about twice a month, while George Bush has one about four times a year. Since you agree that openness and answering pointed questions is a good thing, can you agree with me that the president needs to have a lot more press conferences than he's been having?
The president has a lot of people who work for him, and a lot of things come across his desk that he has to deal with. I think everyone is aware that he has different strengths in his leadership, and obviously there's an awareness that when he speaks, a lot of times there's just people in the room ready to pounce on the word that he comes out and says that isn't as clear as maybe a more quote-unquote person who has better debate skills can have. But through the entire campaign, George W. Bush was grilled. He was
Oh, he was not, Tom. That's ridiculous. He went into forums where he only allowed his own supporters to come in. He was not grilled. His town hall meetings consisted of people asking, hey, Mr. President, can I pray for you? People who supported John Kerry or even were independents were kicked out of those meetings. The only time he was ever asked tough questions were in the three debates.
Yeah, and George Bush went head-to-head with, quote, his entire career, that being John Kerry. And quite frankly, the American people still decided to vote for George W. Bush, because he knows he's going to deliver. But the important thing is that we can question our commanders, and that was done, and then things are put into play in order to improve the situation. But at least there's that open dialogue, and hopefully someday that dialogue will exist even for the soldiers in the Iraqi army, which wouldn't have happened, just about 2 to 3 years ago.
Democracy is a good thing. I hope we get one. In fact, I'm devoting my show tomorrow to the Iraqi situation. But do you think that Rumsfeld's comments, which is, hey, soldier, buck it up, private. You're going into military without a completely formed army. I'm sorry. Get used to it and stop crying about it.
Soldiers, what he said immediately following up the questions and stuff, made them all laugh, relieve the tension a little bit, and allow them to continue the dialogue. And just looking straight up at it and taking that out of context and putting their own spin on it, Secretary Rumsfeld is very concerned about the troops. There was other questions in that press conference. One soldier was concerned about some type of debt that him and a few other people in his group had to incur that was supposed to be being paid by the military, and that wasn't, and there were creditors calling. Secretary Rumsfeld had that soldier's information and that unit's information so that, you know, sometimes when government bureaucracy is so big and so complex, got on that problem, and I'm sure there's been a solution to that, but the media is not reporting that.
Well, actually, Tom, this is an old problem. They've actually been without body armor as well as vehicle armor since the war began, and of course we know that George Bush has been planning this war since January of 2001. People are actually, Terry, can get it the same way. I think clearly it's incompetence here. It's not a question Rumsfeld put it of physics. If all you have to do is go on eBay or go on the internet and buy this stuff, why aren't we doing it for our troops?
When we first went into the war, the amount of armored vehicles which we've had, according to the Pentagon's briefings, which happened afterwards, we have more than tripled and quadrupled the amount of production. America does really well when we go into a war situation, gearing up and responding to this specific need.
Why hasn't the military bought out all the private body armor that's available?
Foot patrol. And then there was kind of a change in thought when the different insurgency regrouped and they started being more effective as far as attacking the tanks and the Humvees.
So, Tom, your argument is that Rumsfeld was listening too closely to the so-called liberal media, and that's why our troops don't have enough? Is that your argument?
A shift, because the insurgency...
Rumsfeld, in that last comment, but I want to read to you a direct quote. It's the one I read earlier in the broadcast, and I want to know what you think of this direct quote by Don Rumsfeld responding to the soldier Thomas Wilson. He said, quote, "It's interesting. I've talked a great deal about this with a team of people who've been working on it hard at the Pentagon. And if you think about it, you can have all the armor in the world on a tank, and a tank can be blown up. And you can have an up-armored Humvee, and it can be blown up, and you can go down," unquote. What do you think of that comment, Tom?
Specifically, obviously I don't know what was said after that and then all the dialogue, and it's hard to take comments that are just surgically taken out of what was said. But I'll say this, it's just saying that the reality is that armor does help, and that's why we're trying to get it to their troops. It's not 100% fail-safe, meaning that just because your vehicle is armored doesn't mean you'll have 100% protection and fatality. The idea behind it is not to decrease or take out the fatalities, because you can't do that in war, but to actually lower the impact or make the injuries less severe.
But that's a non sequitur. I mean, that's, you know what? I would like protection, all right? I'm going in the military. I would like a helmet. And they say, "I'm sorry, sir. You know what? You could be killed even with a helmet, so we won't give you one."
Part of the problem is in the United States, not everyone gets on board and supports our troops 110%. John Kerry, who wanted to send our troops to war, but to make a political statement, decided to vote against the $87 billion.
Changing the subject,
provide the armor to give our troops and to arm our vehicles. So, I mean, there's people who do want to play politics with soldiers, and I think Don Rumsfeld, at his heart and at his core, wants to make sure that they have the supplies that they need.
You're changing the subject. In Iraq, in an elective war that from March 2003, we could have waited until much later till we were prepared, isn't it unconscionable that our troops are there right now and have been there for more than a year and a half without the best equipment available? Can you agree with me? That's just an awful thing.
Our military is doing all it can to provide them with what they need to fight the war that they're on the ground, and they're giving them the support that they need. And I think after those soldiers' comments, and because of the pressure by the media, which we have because this is America, that there'll be even a greater effort, a greater focus, and even a renewed energy to get that done.
And I think it's sad that we have to take pressure from the media, pressure from the American people before the Army listens to its own soldiers. But I want to go to the phones now. If you want to call in and ask Tom a question or ask me a question, grill us. That's what you're right. Just as soldiers can grill Donald Rumsfeld, you too can grill Tom, can grill me. Just dial in 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Tom Robbins.
Yeah, this is Gordon from Bora Bora.
Hello, Gordon. How are you, sir?
I'm all right. I think Tom pretty much took the posture that I wanted him to take. I wanted him to be a Secretary of Defense for a while and possibly be a stand-in for Rumsfeld, who is seemingly getting plastered against the wall by the troops now. I guess I'll change my question and say... How do you think Rumsfeld is being detrimental to the new Bush administration? And if so, who's really pulling the strings on Rumsfeld staying in, as a cabinet member?
Good questions, Tom.
Well, as much as I'd like to think that I have full access to the White House and the inner workings and what's going on, Rumsfeld is in Secretary of Defense and continues as Secretary of Defense because he's doing a good job. That he has the confidence of the President of the United States.
So you disagree with John McCain, who has no confidence in Rumsfeld. You think McCain's wrong there?
I think that's another, and I know that's another example of living in America. If there was nobody, if everybody 110% in the Republican Party or whatever, or in America, was on board with Donald Rumsfeld, and there never was a question about, well, what are we going to do with troop deployment or what's going on with armor, or maybe this wasn't done correctly, then we wouldn't be living in America.
Yeah, Tom, it's America. Some people like Donald Rumsfeld,
yeah,
some don't.
So
I don't, you do.
Senator John McCain, who obviously has insight. And he's
fine. Tell me why you disagree with John McCain. Tell me why you support Don Rumsfeld.
I support Don Rumsfeld because he has done an excellent job in trying to fight the insurgency in Iraq and mobilizing our troops and getting on the ground what it takes to win this war. He has the resolve and the understanding that this is not an insurgency that can just be swept under the carpet and then to be able to just get it out of the way and it's never going to come back and bite us in the butt. But he realizes this is something that we need to take care of now, that we need to get the funds. He's not afraid to go to Congress and to lobby members of Congress for the funds that we need to get the armor, to make the things happen. And when he knows what he needs, he'll go after that, and he'll go toe-to-toe for the soldiers, and he'll go toe-to-toe for the president.
Well, I could just quote Don Rumsfeld on Don Rumsfeld. He says it's not a matter of money. He says it's a matter of physics. He just can't get it done. He has the money, but he just apparently can't go and order the stuff that our own troops are fashioning out of scrapyards. Gordon, you got anything more to say?
Yeah, what do you think about the idea that Rumsfeld is a point man for certain people in the Pentagon who actually supersede the executive branch?
How about it? Is Rumsfeld a puppet?
No, Rumsfeld is not a puppet. I think seeing him with the press conference he's been in or the briefings that he's been involved in, he's a man who is very intelligent, has served not only this president but others, and I don't think he would be in a place himself in a position where he just lets his hands kind of be pulled as puppet strings.
Gordon, one last comment, then I got to go to my next caller.
Go ahead.
All right. Thanks very much for your call. I appreciate it. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Tom Robbins.
Hey, it's big fan Dave from Northern California.
Hey, Dave. How are you?
Real good. Tom, I haven't heard you before, but I have been so unhappy with Republican talk show hosts in general. I feel we've been severely disinformed. I don't know if you guys believe what you're saying. One question I'd ask of you. Can you think of anything that this president has done for the normal, average human being, the citizen? Anything?
It's a good question because we're going to move on after the commercial, Dave, and talk more about Social Security and taxation, things that affect ordinary Americans. But, Tom, what has George Bush done to help ordinary Americans, the average middle class or lower middle class working stiff?
Well, as far as it's concerned, we know that Bush's tax cuts have stimulated the economy. After 9/11, we had the potential to seep into a situation far greater calamity than the Great Depression itself in the 1930s. But George W. Bush, in his understanding that people who work hard like yourself or young people like myself need as much money as they get and not to give it all to the federal government, his tax cuts have been very important. And for me personally, what I'm looking forward to in this next administration is George W. Bush taking on the beast with all its lobbyists and with all its special interest groups and with all its thorns, Social Security, so that my generation is not just paying into a system that will turn out to be our own Enron nightmare, where we're putting in all this types of money and we'll have no benefits. And I applaud George W. Bush because it's not something that's popular. It's not something that'll be easy. But he has indicated that he's willing to go to bat for my generation and to reform and to make the changes that are necessary in Social Security.
Well, Tom, you've given us a good segue. Hang on, Dave. We're going to bring you back after the commercial break. But to me, you've given us a great segue into the next part right after the commercial because we're going to talk about Social Security. We're going to talk about George Bush's tax plan and whether they really are helping the ordinary American. If they are, then why are they so heavily weighted toward the wealthy? And on Social Security, is George Bush's privatization scheme really that? Really, I think what it is simply ending it. George Bush is, in fact, just ending Social Security, as he's doing, by the way, also cutting Pell Grants, cutting the rate of increase in Pell Grants below the population, actually harming the chance for students like Tom to go to college. Doesn't seem to me like he's helping the ordinary American very much. But we'll get back to Dave, make his point. Tom can make his points, too. And you, too, can make your points. Just call in this Debate Tuesday, 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back with the Inside Scoop right after this.
Student loans. It's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
This is a financial update. Average mortgage rates took a slight dip this week.
Sorry to interrupt, but LendingTree.com is the only place where banks compete over your mortgage. Then you get up to 4 real offers to choose from within minutes. So do better and choose from low rates. Call LendingTree now at 1-800-555-TREE. That's 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win.
I know everything. Languages? Yes. Boiling points? Celsius and Fahrenheit? Yes. World capitals? Please. So, not too long ago, I tried to get a refi, and it got turned down. And this is the best part. The loan officer says to me, sir, do you know what your credit score is? So, I looked at her and said, tell me, do you know what the population of Liechtenstein is? Huh? Do you? She didn't.
Get in the know. Check out ScorePower from Equifax. You'll get your credit report, credit score, and you'll learn how your credit decisions can affect your score, all for only $14.95. And knowing that is how you get the credit you deserve. So check out ScorePower at Equifax.com or call 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Well, now I have my credit score up to 760, the same number of days it took Frenchman Michel Lapointe to circle the globe on a bike. Yeah, I'll bet you didn't know that.
Get the power. Score power.
I'm just a cowboy who's got achy knees and the joint pain they call osteoarthritis. I tried over-the-counter pills, they weren't right for me. So I tried some prescriptions and they made me foggy. And that's when I found you, Celebrex, for joint pain relief, no more, no less.
Celebrex targets the source of pain and inflammation. It's non-narcotic. It doesn't make you foggy or slow you down. Ask your doctor about Celebrex celecoxib capsules. Celebrex should not be taken if you've had aspirin-sensitive asthma or allergic reaction due to aspirin or other arthritis medicines or certain drugs called sulfonamides. In rare cases, serious stomach problems such as bleeding can occur without warning. Tell your doctor if you have kidney or liver problems. To learn more, call 1-888-CELEBREX, visit Celebrex.com, or see our ad in Real Simple. Just one prescription Celebrex gives 24-hour relief.
Ask your doctor about Celebrex. Joint pain relief, no more, no less.
There's a fire inside who will never give up. We are what we are, and it's never enough. Like the woods
in the sun. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine. Today is Debate Tuesday, and I've got on the line Tom Robbins, the state chair of the Utah College Republicans. We talked about Rumsfeld's response to the troops about lack of armor, which I think actually was quite similar to Theresa Hines Carey's response during the campaign. In other words, shove it. Deal with it. This is the armor we have. Tough it out. Tom obviously doesn't agree with that interpretation, but hey, that's why we have him on the air. And just before the break, we were talking about Social Security and specifically what George Bush has done to help the average American. I've got Dave on the line. He called in to ask that question. And Tom Robbins said, well, Social Security is helping us. It seems to me, though, Tom, that what really is going on in Social Security is Bush is simply ending the program. The idea was, back in the 1930s, during the Great Depression, that the government would be a pensioner of last resort, that you wouldn't die or starve when you were old if you weren't able to save enough, but the government would be there for you. That was the whole purpose of Social Security. We didn't have it, and of course, we had the Great Depression. Now, at a time when actually pensions are being cut, when corporations are not fully funding pensions, George Bush wants to privatize Social Security, which is a fancy way of saying ending it. You provide for your own retirement. Don't expect the government to provide for you. You're on your own. In other words, aren't we going back, Tom, to just the way we were in the 1920s before the Great Depression?
Absolutely not. In fact, Mark, what is the definition of a pyramid scheme?
The definition of pyramid scheme is a private group that's not backed by anyone, where people go in and they put money in and it's paid out to somebody else, and they get increasing rates of returns. And that's what you're going to argue Social Security is,
well,
right?
Well, pyramid scheme is where you have a group of people at the top who are relying on new people to come in so that they can cash out. And eventually, why it's called a scheme is that there won't be enough people putting in money into the system for the people to cash out, and the whole thing will collapse. Thus, this is Social Security. If you're worried about Enron, if you're worried about Tyco, and you want to put those CEOs in jail because they failed to provide the retirement benefits for their employees because of their scheming and because of their lies, Social Security is promising to my generation, as we pour millions to billions of our own hard-earned money into the system, that we'll have retirement waiting for us, whereas in fact, Social Security as it stands today is relying on more people coming into the system and paying into the system just to pay off the responsibilities that they have. And to my generation, it'll be an empty promise.
Nice try, Tom, and that's true, but it's only true because of George Bush's tax policies. Recall that under the surpluses of Bill Clinton, we devoted enough money to Social Security to actually protect Social Security for all of us. Bill Clinton made the system solvent for 75 years, more than enough to cover my retirement and yours, Tom, but George Bush spent all the money in the lockbox. That's right, all that money that you give and FICA and all that stuff that went to the war in Iraq, George Bush spent it. Now, there's obviously a question of policy here. Do you think that Social Security funds, the money that people put away from their paycheck, should be saved for their retirement? Or do you think it should go to Halliburton to fund Iraq? Now, I think most Americans think that their own money should go for their own retirement. Bush decided it should go all to Halliburton. That's why it's bankrupt, Tom. You know that. It's not because of what Social Security is about.
The reason why it's bankrupt is because when Social Security was formed, the average life expectancy for the American worker at that time was 64 to 65. So the mathematical equation in place to be able to provide a retirement benefit for these people is far exceeded, as now we're looking at a life expectancy rate of about 72 to 73.
That's all true, but you know that under Bill Clinton, the system was solvent. It's only because of George Bush's policies that the system isn't solvent. And I guess my question is, when you look at Bush's plan, which will cost $2 trillion, where's that money going to come from? What do you think, Tom? Increased taxes or lesser benefits to people?
You're saying that it's going to cost us $2 trillion, and there will be a cost.
That's what Greenspan says. I'm not making this up.
Anytime you kick a bloated giant, which is the Social Security system, to try to get a change or to try to make it so it is more effective, there will be a cost involved.
And where should it come from?
Today, the cost of not acting in this Congress or under this administration is estimated anywhere between $4 to $6 billion down the road because of the cost of not acting.
But Tom,
the actual real cost down the road.
Answer my question. Your policy, Bush's policy, the one you support, the $2 trillion cost, do you think it should be paid for by increased taxes or by lesser benefits to retirees down the road or by increased borrowing, which will lead to even more taxes and even more decreased benefits in the future? Which do you think we should go to?
I don't think those are all the options that are available to us, Mark.
What are the other options?
I don't have a copy of the federal budget in front of me. But, however, I do know that there's always places of waste that can be
okay.
cut.
Okay. Well, give me your $2 trillion in waste. Where would you cut it from? The war in Iraq cost $230 billion, so we'd have to cut out 10 wars in Iraq to pay for this. Even if we give up the war in Iraq, that's a tenth of it. Let's see, nine-tenths less. Well, the entire budget.
We also know, Mark, that because of the tax cuts and the improved economy, that we're forecasting that we are going to be doing better than we have in the past years as far as our revenue, even though we have a lower tax structure.
Wait. Now, so you're arguing, again, this is the Laffer curve, which I think has been laughed out of most economics classes. You're actually arguing that when you cut tax rates at this rate, you get more taxes. That's really what you're arguing?
Down the road, because of the stimulating the economy, that you're giving opportunities for people to go out and buy the DVD players.
Uh-huh. So it's all going to magically come in.
That's what they want back. That's what they want in their pocket. But the point is, it will cost money now, but it'll cost us. Where are you going to get an extra $4 trillion down the road to fix it?
Well, you
because
get it
don't
the way
now. It's going to cost $4 to $6 trillion instead of two now.
You do it the way Clinton did it. You repeal the Bush tax cuts and you put the surplus money into Social Security to make this situation solvent. Your plan, you haven't told us where the $2 trillion is going to come from. Maybe we should cut out all the defense budget or maybe all of Social Security. I'm not sure where you're going to get this $2 trillion. I don't think Bush knows. I don't think anybody knows, Tom. And at the end of the day, what are we left with? You've invested for your own retirement. You're just taking us back to the 1920s.
Yeah, what are we left with? We're left with saying that people make better decisions when they're invested. when they have a say of where their money goes and they can watch that money grow and they have an opportunity to make decisions for themselves,
well,
that they'll be better. It's just like
it's great rhetoric.
Given the opportunity to be able to make decisions and is invested instead of being told, well, you just need to do this, 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 and that.
Tom, it's great rhetoric, but we know
it
that
works,
it...
Mark.
Well, no, in the 1920s, we had people investing for themselves. We didn't have Social Security. We had people working in factories. If they lost a limb, oh, well, they were out. There was no disability. They just died. I don't know if you ever read The Jungle by Upton Sinclair.
Oh, that's what you guys like to do. You like to scare people. We're not going to go back to the 1920s.
We're not? We're
no,
not
because it's dramatically changed as far as the stock market is concerned.
People were providing
as far as
people for themselves.
Getting their arms cut off in the jungle.
Right.
Just using scare tactics.
No, but people were providing for themselves in the 1920s, and we had the Great Depression, and people were literally starving. I mean, don't you think there should be a minimum social safety net?
People are going to be starving, and your arms are going to be cut off at work and stuff. You're using scare tactics.
No, but today we have disability. We have a social safety net. We have protections against those kinds of things. We have things like lawyers, by the way. They can sue to help you. We also have disability payments. We have death benefits. We have a, I'm not saying that you should live your entire life at Social Security. I think most Americans do provide for their own retirement, and the government helps them through IRAs, 401k plans. That's all terrific. You should supplement Social Security. But at the same time, if you fail to provide for your retirement, isn't it nice when you're 60, 70, 80, 90 years of age to know that you have this basic nest egg? I'll tell you another thing Social Security does that you can't do privately. Let me just make one more point, then you can respond. One other thing that Social Security does is you don't know how long you're going to live. You just don't know it. And the nice thing about Social Security is if you live to be 95, 96, your retirement savings may well run out, but the government makes sure that you have that minimum level to survive. And that way, if you die at age 72, instead of the money going to you know, your kids, the money goes to people who are older. It's like an insurance benefit. In other words, you don't know whether you're going to live to be 72 or 102, but if you have Social Security, the government is there for you so you won't starve. And I don't understand why you don't want this minimum safety net.
We do want that minimum safety net, and that's why we need to go to privatizing accounts. That's why we need to give people the opportunity to be in charge of some aspects of the investment so that they have an ownership mentality.
Okay, so I go in and I invest it all in Enron and I lose it all. Does the government still provide for me?
The plan, as far as it's been equated or designed or articulated, as far as how much you're allowed to invest, as far as I know, you won't be allowed to invest all of it, but it'll be a portion of it. That you'll only be able to put some of that money, not all of it. So you'll have a combination of stuff that'll be coming, possibly a check from the government. But you'll also have that opportunity to get that other part of your Social Security from the government. It's a dialogue we need to have, but unfortunately the Democratic Party in many ways is controlled by the lobbyists and special interest groups who, even if you, at the mention of Social Security and change in the same sentence, throw up their hands in hysteria and immediately start sounding the alarms and don't even let the dialogue go to the floor.
Well, I think we're having
Congressman Matt Suey sitting there as the ranking member on Social Security is freaked out and is the gatekeeper for the Democratic Party, not really the American people, and they're turning off my generation.
Well, I think we're having a dialogue right now, but I myself am freaked out by the possibility that we could have old people starving in the streets as we did in the 1930s. If you're arguing...
There you go, Mark. You're using scare tactics.
It's not scare tactics.
Yes, it is, Mark.
Look, to the extent that people... You're saying people should be able to privately provide for their retirement with government help. We do that. That's what IRAs are. That's what 401ks are. I don't know any Democrat that doesn't support those things. But to the extent that you're talking about taking the minimum, and I think it's pretty much a minimum, that Social Security allows people to survive on, and cutting that benefit, which you have to do, right? If you're going to have more money that supposedly comes from privatization, you got to cut the basic minimum benefit. And if you do that, if people don't have enough to survive on, then I don't know what happens to them, Tom.
Well, I know what happens to people of my generation. People of my generation think that there's a greater chance that they'll see a UFO one day and they'll actually see a paycheck from Social Security because it is a pyramid scheme.
Not under Bill Clinton.
Somebody comes after Enron and someone comes after Tyco and says that the corporate world needs to clean itself up. The American government needs to stop basically leading astray my generation and telling them that all is well. But George W. Bush is going to look at this issue. Democrats are going to scream about it because their constituent core base, as they understand, within the Democratic Party, many times doesn't want this issue to be looked at. and we'll use it as a scare tactic, and we'll say the same things that you did. Have you read The Jungle? We're going to go back to people's arms being cut off and dying in the streets and eating dog food.
Well, you know, if you don't provide a minimum... We already have homeless people in this country, Tom. We already have people that don't have minimum support. And if you cut that minimum support even further, I got to tell you, Democrats, we stand up for working people. That's why under Bill Clinton, Social Security was solvent. And I don't see that. But I'll tell you, Dave has been holding on a long time. Dave, let me see if you've got further comments on this debate.
Yes, I thought you had forgotten me completely there, Mark.
I haven't. Tom, I knew you were there.
Okay, Tom, I have been listening to you, and I'm trying to decide if you yourself are severely disinformed or if you are knowingly misinforming people right now. You have to know that you have a White House crew that cares exclusively about the very wealthiest of people in this country and cares not at all about the normal person. You say tax cuts, they went 90% to the millionaire plus. And in stimulated the economy. We have an economy, sir, that is, what, $8, $9 trillion in debt right now? Wages are down. The number of jobs are down. You're telling me or us that this has stimulated the economy? It has stimulated the economy if you're already a multimillionaire. Yes, yes, you're doing very well. The average working man now is hurting and will be a whole lot more. He wants to benefit this very wealthy class by having a very large volume of people competing for minimum wage jobs with no benefits. That way, the very rich will have to pay less. That's a reality you must be aware of.
Tom?
Actually, I don't know where those numbers are coming from as far as jobs are down.
They are down, Tom. Clearly, when Bush has fewer jobs now than when he took office. You don't deny that.
Yeah, but things have happened, Mark, since he took office. And recently, as far as we've seen in the last couple of months, job growth is up. Democrats don't want to talk about it because, you know, when Kerry was running for president, by golly, if the economy was in any way, shape, or form moving in the up direction, that was just bad news for them. So Democrats just prayed for bad
news.
But Tom, Kerry
address,
was able to move forward his agenda.
Address
but
Dave's
look,
point.
I'm
Dave...
someone who's just getting into the job market.
Okay,
yeah,
but...
it's tough. You got to have the opportunity. You got to get out there and be motivated. And
Tom,
go to...
address Dave's point. Dave's point is that Bush has weighted his policies to help the affluent at the expense of the poor and the middle class. We know, for example, that the rich have a much lesser tax burden and the middle class has a higher tax burden. I mean, can't you at least agree with the caller that this is an administration that's looking out for the super wealthy much more than the average American?
This is an administration who helped liberate 50 million people from the clutches of poverty and tyranny. You're saying that
that's not the average American, Tom.
That they care about is rich people who are, you know, buttering their rolls and...
Sure, Halliburton shareholders are doing very well. I agree with you, but the average American...
And America are doing well because the economy has picked up since September 11th and didn't slip into a Great Depression-type 1930s mentality.
Actually, what this economy did do is have the slowest recovery since the Great Depression. And I've always argued that when you put a lot of money in rich people's pockets, it doesn't move the economy along. It doesn't get people out there buying Christmas gifts. Because when you're very rich, how many yachts do you need? But when you're poor or middle class...
How many did Kerry have? I don't know. I lost count.
Well, that's the point. People like John Kerry understand that they shouldn't get all the benefits of America. That should go to the lower and the middle class, too. Dave, thank you very much for your call.
You. The difference between Kerry and Bush is that Kerry cared about the normal person, and Bush could care less about them.
Absolutely not. And that's why Teresa Hines Kerry didn't want to divulge and was basically forced into divulging the financial tax records.
But no matter how rich...
George W. Bush and Laura Bush were paying more in taxes than John Kerry himself.
No matter how rich Teresa Hines Kerry is, she believed in using national policy to help the lower and the middle class, the average American, while George Bush, you know what he does? He pushes his policy toward the super rich. Dave, thank you very much for your call. We've got to take another commercial break. When we come back, we're going to wrap up with Tom Robbins and also address some of your comments on the blog. If you want to call in, just dial toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back with more of Debate Tuesday here on The Scoop right after this.
Here's a message about Anderson Windows from J.T. Hurst & Company. a division of T.W. Perry. If you're thinking about remodeling your home, keep in mind that windows play a big part, so it's important to get the right ones. Anderson not only offers finely crafted windows and patio doors in thousands of sizes and styles, they also give you natural wood interiors, low-maintenance exteriors, and long-lasting, energy-saving performance. Stop in and see the full line of Anderson Windows at J.T. Hurst & Company, a division of T.W. Perry. The pros at J.T. Hurst can locate a contractor to do the job for you or give you some helpful tips on how you can do it yourself. J.T. Hurst, where customer service comes first, a division of T.W. Perry. On Catoctin Circle in Leesburg, Anderson Windows. Long live the home.
How many different organizations list you as a member? You might be a member of a sports team, a book club, travel or CD club. But what does that membership really mean? Does membership in a book club allow you to vote on who runs the organization? Can you help shape the long-term future of your CD club? I don't think so. You can, however, shape the future of your electric company. That is, if you're a NOVEC customer. NOVEC, Northern Virginia Electric Cooperative, is owned by the consumers we serve and governed by a board of directors elected from the membership. Pretty cool, huh? But wait, there's more. NOVEC's customers share in the company's profits. Last year, we distributed more than $9.1 million in capital credits to our membership. The power to vote and a share of the profits. Membership doesn't get much better than this. NOVEC, locally based and member-owned. For a list of customer services, answers to your questions, and even employment opportunities, visit our website at www.novec.com. NOVEC. I got the power to move,
yeah. If you've been thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
One in four adults has high blood pressure. If you're one of them and you have a cold, Coricidin HBP has surprising news for you. The American Heart Association recognizes that decongestants found in many leading cold medicines can raise your blood pressure and interfere with blood pressure medication. So why risk it? Only decongestant-free Coricidin HBP provides a line of safe, powerful cold and flu medication specially formulated for people with high blood pressure. So make the safe choice.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. I've been reading the blog to see what my listeners are thinking. If you want to add to the blog, just go to www.radioinsidescoop.com. And if you want to call in, all you have to do is dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP. On the blog, I would say they fall into three main categories. The first has nothing to do with our discussion today. It has to do with the voting systems in Ohio. There's a long discussion on the blog that most of those comments were before this show even began. Let me assure you folks, I am looking into it, and I'm devoting Thursday's show, its entire show, to the experts on the ground in Ohio to tell us what's going on there. I hope you'll tune in for that. The main two points, of course, we talked about today were the comments by Rumsfeld and our Tom and my discussion on Social Security. Let me read to you some of the comments we have. Let's start with Rumsfeld. We've got Rick writing, "It's pretty obvious that the administration does not support our troops. I don't think Rummy gives a damn about our troops, and when Republicans defend him, I don't think that they support our troops. They could care less what happens to our soldiers. All they care about is consolidating power and lining their pockets with blood money." And Gordon writes, "The soldiers cheering against Rumsfeld at Specialist Wilson's question was a good indicator of what's going on. Also, National Guard units might be discriminated against supply-wise." There were also a lot of questions, a lot of comments, I should say, on Social Security. And one listener writes, "The only problem with Social Security is Bush dipping his grubby little craws in it so he can hand out cash to his buddies." Then we have the comment here by Jenny in Pennsylvania. Jenny writes, "Actually, it won't be bankrupt until 2052, this time agreeable with conservative Social Security trustees. So it's not even in crisis right now. Medicare, on the other hand, is. If Tom disagrees with this, he needs to provide proof of how this is a vital issue right now. Rick writes, it's not going bankrupt because people are living longer. That's the most moronic statements I've heard. People are also working longer, which means they are paying in more also. If anything, perhaps there isn't as much money going in because more American jobs are being shipped to China by those communist-loving Republicans in the White House. Neil writes, according to the Congressional Budget Office, Social Security is solvent until 2052. The boomers have been paying in and there are huge surpluses. I shouldn't let Tom spread lies on my show, Neil writes. Let Bush put the $2 trillion back into the lockbox instead of borrowing more money. I'm sorry, it's Nell, not Neil. I apologize for that, Nell. Nell goes on to say, the economy is not improving except for the upper classes. In fact, indicators are going down again, jobs are going, and the people will not have a say in the Social Security investment. Social Security, Nell writes, is not an investment, it's an insurance plan. Can you imagine Allstate letting you invest part of your auto insurance in a plan of your choice? It's going to be automatically put into an index fund, and Wall Street will be the one who survives. Finally, Nell writes, some say the cost will be as much as 50 cents per dollar. It's no more a pyramid than Allstate. Wrong metaphor, Tom. All right, Tom, there's a lot of comments there for you to respond to. Let me start with Nell's point, which is that Social Security is an insurance plan, not a pyramid scheme. The whole idea is to protect us so that we have a basic minimum when we get to our old age.
Well, the difference between Allstate is that if, you know, for example, right now I have Geico insurance, I pay that. The only way that I'll get any money out of Geico is that if something happens and there is a wreck. The difference with Social Security, it says when you reach a certain age, it doesn't matter if you're Bill Gates or if you're eating, you know, whatever off the street, you'll get a certain amount per month until you die. So whereas Allstate, I'm making a contract where I'm saying I will never see my money in case there's an emergency or if I have a problem, which I can make a claim to. Social Security says no matter what, you will get that money.
Well, actually,
so they're
Tom,
making IOUs that they can't cash. And the other thing I just want to bring up very briefly is when talking about the troops, and it's obvious that the troops don't support Rumsfeld and they're frustrated, and that when the troops had the opportunity to cast their vote, whether to change commander in chief, overwhelmingly, who did they vote for? They voted for President George W. Bush to reelect him. And that's why, you know, in the 2000 elections, Gore and others tried to, you know, stop the absentee ballots from coming in and stuff because military
that's
ballots
not true.
Historically, historically go towards Republicans.
They do historically go to Republicans. There's no question that the people in our military overall support the Republican Party. That has to do with a lot of the fact that it tends to be poor, rural people, and they're the same people who vote Republican.
So you're
but
saying that
my listeners
is less intelligent, and that's why they vote Republican?
No, I'm saying that poorer rural people tend to vote Republican. Largely, many of them are fundamentalist Christians. That's a large part of the Republican support. I know that. And also, poorer rural people are the ones more likely to join the military. But that doesn't change the fact that our troops need armor and that Rumsfeld's not providing it. And what my listeners focused on, Tom, and I think you turned it around a little bit, was not whether our troops support Rumsfeld, but whether Rumsfeld supports our troops. Or whether he's sitting there in the Pentagon saying, hey, you know, if you think about it, you could get killed no matter what protection you have, so we're not going to supply the protection. That, I think, is what my listeners were focused on.
To say that Donald Rumsfeld wakes up every day and just, you know, goes from breakfast to lunch appointment and you know, eats buttered rolls and has, you know, creme de la creme coffee cakes and stuff and doesn't care one iota about our troops is absolutely wrong. It mischaracterizes him as a person.
Well, I didn't say Rumsfeld didn't care one iota about our troops, but I do know this.
He's doing everything that he can.
He's not doing everything he can. Tommy Franks, when he first talked about this war, suggested 500,000 troops in a seven-month buildup. In other words, we would do the same to invade Iraq that we did with Desert Storm when Colin Powell ran it, use overwhelming force. Remember, we were actually doing more than we did in Kuwait. In Kuwait, we liberated a fairly small country. Iraq's a lot larger. The Kuwaitis did recognize us as liberators. The Iraquis did not. Franks asked for 500,000 troops.
That's a fundamental flaw as far as the argument is that the Iraquis don't recognize us as liberators.
Well, the latest poll shows that 2% do, Tom, and 98% do not. I mean, you know, when we pulled down, we got a few of them to pull down a statue of Saddam Hussein, but it was a couple hundred.
That was 100% completely staged. Is that what you're saying? It was a big conspiracy?
I'm saying there were a couple hundred, and if you look at photos of it, you see there's a couple hundred pulling down the statue, and you see all around the perimeter U.S. troops keeping most of the people out.
Well,
the point is that the Iraqis...
Next week is when the trials will begin for some of Saddam Hussein's henchmen.
I'll tell you.
We'll be able to just start to scratch the surface. I mean,
I'll tell you when we'll know, Tom. Well, there's going to be elections in Iraq in January, and I think you will see that the elected party will insist that American troops leave. And then, you know, I wonder if they'll consider us as liberators. But
I want to move on, though, Social Security.
As far as
the long term, that's obviously interesting when you give people democracy. And speaking of democracy, I just saw on CNN reporting that in Minnesota, it's just kind of a fun tidbit, the Electoral College, as you may or may not know, your listeners, met yesterday.
Yes, I read
in
this.
In Minnesota, and it hasn't happened since 1988, a person in the Electoral College actually changed his vote and voted for Senator Edwards, not John Kerry.
Yeah, I know. Some are saying that he mistook the two names and put them in the wrong order. But actually, it's not since 1988. Just for trivia buffs, actually in 2000, the Gore elector for the District of Columbia withheld her vote to protest the fact that the District of Columbia does not have voting rights in Congress. So
that's a completely different issue. But, I don't know. Is that indicating perhaps that the...
It's indicating that the Electoral College...
The Democratic Party as its whole is going to try to steer away from... perhaps the most liberal members of the United States Senate looking for
no.
a moderate.
It indicates that the Electoral College is an anachronistic mistake and it needs to go. And I want to know if you agree with me on that, Tom.
I think that the Electoral College, if it could be changed, which is something that I could support, if it could be changed, it would need to be done all at once.
I agree.
And it just couldn't be a state by state or state.
Fair enough. Let's
if
have...
the American people want to do it all at once, and that's something that they want to get behind.
And you'd vote for it. Good. That's good to hear. Let me make – we've got about 1 minute left. I do want to bring back the question of Social Security, whether it's like insurance. Parts of it clearly are insurance. If you are disabled, that's disability insurance. Social Security pays for that. If you're unemployed, that's unemployment insurance. Social Security pays for that. But even the part that you mentioned, Tom, when you get to be old, it is a kind of insurance, and it's the insurance against, frankly, living too long. If you may not have enough retirement to provide for yourself when you get to be 85, 90, 95, 100, and what Social Security does is it takes insurance and it says people who are 72 and dead don't need money as much as people who are 95 and living. So it pools all of our resources together and says if you happen to live longer, yes, you get more money under Social Security, and that way we have old people who aren't dying in the streets rather than just giving away the money as inheritance. And one of my big problems with the Republican tax plan is the way it says if you're a working person, you pay a lot of taxes, but if you inherit money or just get dividends or interest, you shouldn't pay any taxes at all. Last comment, Tom.
People need to have an incentive in the United States of America to be able to build wealth and to be able to take risks. People who become successful entrepreneurs don't do so because they're not content to just sitting on their hands, but they go out there and they work hard and they're willing to take risks.
And where we differ, Tom, and we're going to have to end it here, where we differ is I'm all for capitalism, I'm all for people taking risks with excess money, but when it comes to a minimum safety net, that is something that we Democrats will never give up. Thanks, Tom, for appearing this election. Excuse me, I should